Okay, the next case we have on docket is docket number 64669, Mitchell Capital versus Powercom Inc. And Mr. Wickerby, are you ready to proceed?
I am, Your Honor.
Okay.
May it please the Court, my name is Robert Werbicki. I am counsel for Mitchell Capital, the appellant in this matter. Mitchell asks this Court to remove the barrier preventing it from being able to collect on Powercom's most tangible asset, the life insurance proceeds left to it by its president and founder, Jacob Reynolds, to satisfy a judgment Mitchell properly received, obtained over 6 years ago. The case implicates concepts of due process, concurrent judicial jurisdiction and comity, and the rights of creditors. The default judgment that was obtained by Powercom, first, in order to get there, we have to have the default judgment obtained in Department 13 removed so that we can proceed against these particular proceeds. To get there, some factual background is perhaps proper. Oh, incidentally, could I reserve 5 minutes of time?
Certainly.
Thank you. Powercom was a general contractor that specialized in building cell phone towers. Mitchell Capital, or its sister company, actually provided laborers to companies such as Powercom that did not have a constant labor force but needed labor on occasion. In 2008, Jacob Reynolds obtained life insurance for both his family and his company in such that each would receive $550,000 worth of proceeds upon his death. By 2009, Powercom and Jacob Reynolds had amassed over $700,000 worth of debt to Mitchell Capital associated with the temporary labor that was used by Powercom. When Powercom did not pay this obligation, a confession of judgment was filed in the 8th Judicial District in Department Number 17. This made Mitchell Powercom's largest creditor. In 2010, Jacob Reynolds died, my understanding is correct, from an apparent prescription drug overdose. At the time his company was being investigated by the Contractors Board, he was involved in other lawsuits. His wife was divorcing him, and his company was pretty deeply in debt. Under these circumstances, there were some potential issues regarding the insurance coverage.
My understanding was that the insurance proceeds were paid.
They were paid. They were paid in July of 2010.
Okay.
Prior to that, in March initially, Mitchell hired an attorney to remind Powercom of it, that the obligation continued in a time frame that was unsure what would exactly be happening with Powercom. In May, there was a debtor's exam in which it was disclosed. First, this was the first time Mitchell knew about the insurance proceeds being left to Powercom. It was also determined at that time that the insurance company still had some questions, and as a consequence, it hadn't been paid yet. A few months later, without notifying Mitchell, the insurance proceeds were paid to both Ms. Reynolds and Powercom. At that time, Mitchell was not proceeding simply because they were going to allow the insurance issue to work itself out, and they were never notified that those issues had been resolved. About a year later, a year after Mr. Reynolds' death, a cause of action was filed in Department 13 as opposed to 17, requesting that the life insurance proceeds left to Powercom be held exempt from any creditors of Powercom. This implicated dozens of creditors and at least two judgment creditors. Then service began. Service of process issues began. In July of 2010, There was an order from Judge Denton that allowed additional time in which to serve the various debtors, defendants, including Mitchell Capital. On August 1st, or about there, that led to the single attempt to personally serve Viracom's largest creditor, Mitchell Capital. At this point, Mitchell was owed over $250,000. The single attempt, apparently there was some confusion about who they actually asked to serve. The resident agent was a company called BG Management, whose president was Barry Channing, who was also the president of Mitchell Capital. Apparently the process server went in and asked to serve Mitchell Capital, who no longer had a business at that address, but the resident agent was still at that address. Because of this apparent confusion, the process server did not leave the summons and complaint, simply left. Did not leave it with the person at the desk of suitable age, simply left.
Let me ask you a question. Here's where I have trouble with this whole thing. And at first, my thought was, it looks like the defendant was trying to conceal itself or trying to dodge service at some point, and then now coming back trying to take advantage of that fact. The way I read this initially, the facts indicated that the process server stopped by the proper address where the resident agent was from Mitchell Capital, talked to Shark Fuller, I believe her name was, and the process server was told that Insight Property is there now and Mitchell Capital is no longer there, which Barry Chandler was the president of Mitchell Capital, correct?
That's correct, Your
Honor. And the resident agent was BC Management, which was still located at that location, correct?
Correct.
I'm having trouble with that. Tell me why I should.
I think it's because there just seems to be a mix-up, because the process server, we don't know exactly what happened. All we have is the affidavit of the process server, which isn't terribly clear. And he seems to indicate that he asked for Mitchell Capital and nothing more. We don't know if he identified himself as a process server. I have papers to serve. I have something else. All we know is that he appeared to ask for Mitchell Capital. And he was just told, well, they're not here anymore. No follow-up. No request for additional information. Well, where can I find Barry Channing, or where can I find BC Management, or anything else? He simply left. He could have also just left the service of process there. It was the right address. It was listed as such. Why not just leave the complaint?
Is there an obligation if they changed their address to notify that there's been a change of address?
I believe so, but under BSAF, that kind of violation of a corporate statute doesn't deprive them of the ability to defend. Besides,
does that really provide a sufficient basis to set aside this default? And it's a discretionary matter, certainly with the judge, to look at all the facts.
It is discretionary to look at all the facts, but it appears that the basis for setting aside, if I file within the requisite 6-month time frame, is that they have to be substantially prejudiced in some way in order for the default to be set aside.
How do we know that funds weren't already spent or somehow encumbered in another way? Wouldn't that be a laches issue?
It could potentially, but there's no evidence associated with that. It's simply that the money was not there, had been released. There was no indication of what happened to the money, that it had been somehow otherwise encumbered or any other thing that implicate laches other than the fact that the money was handed over. In fact, several months later, when I represented a different client, Young Construction Services, we asked for some of the money to be returned to cover the full potential obligation associated with the work that Young Construction Services provided. And that money was deposited back into the court. So it indicated, at least at that point, that the money had not been distributed, encumbered, or otherwise disposed of.
What was the basis for the district judge not setting aside the default? What record was made?
The record indicated that he believed that Mitchell Capital had notice of the lawsuit and did nothing associated with it. He also stated that he believed that PowerCom had changed its position, basically relying on the Carson case. Carson, I wouldn't think, would be quite on point, simply because the in that instance, the there was a building project that was substantially complete by the time the party had asked to set aside the default judgment. So the only implication for latches that he did provide was essentially that he believed that there had been a change of position without indicating what that change in position was.
Well, I haven't been in private practice since 1996, but it used to be, like, routinely that you would set aside the default and you'd have to pay the piper. Usually it was like $500 or $1,000 to the other side for the time they had spent in giving the default, and then you'd set aside. Was that mentioned at all by the judge or by yourself?
It wasn't, I believe, by either one of us. I was basically indicating, I was a little bit surprised myself that it was not set aside simply under the circumstances, because when I first contacted Mitchell Capital, it was on behalf of Young Construction Services because I had this huge creditor with priority in front of me if I collected on anything. And I was contesting the insurance issue in front of me at that time. And we were concerned that even if we got a judgment, they might just take it away from us, as they would probably be entitled to because we didn't have any judgments against Mitchell or anything to that effect. So I contacted Mitchell Capital, and he seemed honestly surprised by the whole situation. So with that, I've only got about 3 minutes left. I suppose I'll reserve that.
Also, one quick question.
Sure.
My records indicate that we don't have a transcript from the NRCP 60C motion.
I thought I provided it. In fact, I read it. In fact, I did pull it off the 8th Judicial District, but I can provide another copy of it.
If you would, that would we'd appreciate that.
Certainly, Your Honor.
And we chewed into your time quite a little bit, and I've got a question. Even if this were sent back, whether or not your claim that the life insurance proceeds are executable, even though they were paid to a corporation. I've got some issues on that, but I'm going to add 2 minutes to your time, Mr. Aldrich. I'm going to do the same for you, give you extra two minutes.
Okay.
Thank you.
Do you want me to address that right now?
No, it's not right now. Have you address it. Think about it for a while, and then have you address it on rebuttal.
I will. Thank you.
Thank you. Good afternoon. May it please the Court. I'm John Aldrich. I represent the respondents in this matter. And what I want to do is touch on a couple of questions that came up and then talk about the service issues. To clarify, I don't know that there's evidence in the record because there isn't. We didn't do discovery in this particular case, but all the money is not there. We went and got a court order, and she was given the money. She's a young widow, has 3 kids that she's raising, has now gone to nursing school, and is moving forward raising her kids. So all the money is not there, and I'll get to that a little bit more. It definitely goes to the latches argument. The thing I want the court to understand here is that from the very beginning, Ms. Reynolds, and on behalf of PowerCom, has tried to do everything forthright up front. And that's what we brought the lawsuit. If she was trying to run away, she'd have just run away. Okay? When we got the insurance proceeds, we went ahead and went to court. And a couple of things to note. In March of 2010, about a month after Mr. Reynolds passed away, Ms. Reynolds received a letter from Ms. Gottschall on behalf of Mitchell Capital. About 2 months later, in May of 2010, she went and attended a judgment debtors exam, and during that judgment debtors exam, she testified about the insurance proceeds. At that time, she did not have the insurance proceeds. There was some contest going on, and I was helping her with that. But we notified them at that time that there may be insurance proceeds. It's not in the record. I can represent that off the record in a conversation with the attorney.
If it's not in the record, let's not go.
Enough. I will stay away from it. But I will let you know that. So then about a year later, February 14th of 2011, we filed this lawsuit. Okay? So we were not running anywhere. We were being very methodical about it. About a month after that, in March, I contacted Ms. Gottschalk and notified her that we had filed this lawsuit indeed and asked if she would accept service. Okay? I did not hear back from her. She indicated to me at that time she would check with the client and get back to me. I can give you the reference if you need it. There's a letter that confirms all of that.
We have that.
Okay. And at that point, I didn't hear back from her. About 12 days later, on the 22nd of March of 2011, I sent her a letter, and I attached the summons, the complaint, and also an acceptance of service, and asked her if she would accept service on behalf of her client. So that's two attempts to serve them. She then, on April 7th of that year, got back to me and said, no, she's not authorized to accept service, and she would not be representing them anymore. And so we went ahead.
Any further contacts her regarding what was communicated to her client or what wasn't?
No.
Just the fact that she wouldn't accept service or she wasn't authorized to accept service and was no longer representing that client.
Correct. She indicated to me that she would check with the client.
Yes.
But she did not specifically say to me, I checked with the client.
If she says she's not authorized to accept service, then it implies the client knew and wouldn't allow her authorized acceptance of service.
And that is certainly my interpretation of that, and based on the conversations, that was my understanding of what had occurred.
Okay.
So now we fast forward to August 1st of that year, when we sent someone to the resident agent address, 5024 Alta Drive, which, by the way, is just, it's not a big building, it's just a little building. They went to the right place, and they talked to Char Fuller, and the affidavit, I guess we have a difference of interpretation here, but to me, the affidavit says, and it's at page 442 in the record, that they attempted to personally serve a copy of the documents on Defendant Mitchell Capital by serving BCMGT LLC, registered agent, at that address. And then, Your Honor was correct. Char Fuller was there. She indicated, according to this, that Mitchell Capital used to be there but hadn't been there in about 8 years. Now, this is significant for a couple of reasons. I interpret that to mean that they're trying to evade service, mainly because, and also in the record, is they were told, the process was told Inside Property was there. Inside Property, the president and resident, registered agent for Inside Property is Char Fuller, and the member, director, is Barry Channing. Barry Channing is the person who was involved there in Mitchell Capital. So we're in the right place, talking to the right person, and they're refusing to accept the service. And so based on that, I've already done at least two attempts to counsel and heard back, and then we sent someone out there to personally serve. We asked for permission to serve by publication.
Now, did anybody else answer? I see that there were other defendants.
Yes. My recollection is that there were two other defendants who, I believe they did answer. We did a summary judgment motion. They didn't actually fight it. From a strategic standpoint, just to let the court know what happened, we basically picked the biggest set of eight creditors and served them first. And Mitchell Capital was the biggest creditor. And we figured at that point we would file a motion for summary judgment, find out either the proceeds are exempt or they're not, we would move on. Obviously, that's not what has happened eventually, but that's where we were.
What has happened on that issue?
Pardon?
What has happened on that issue of the exemption?
Everyone has been, there was no opposition to that motion for summary judgment. Young's Construction, I filed a motion for summary judgment when Mr. Werbicki was representing Young's Construction. The court found a couple of issues of fact, and in that case actually resolved, so that was never, certainly not a final judgment on that issue.
So there's never been a law of the case that this is exempt or not exempt, to answer.
It's actually an issue that was raised.
Mm-hmm. It was raised, and by default judgment, part of my default judgment is that it is exempt. But we have not had someone come in on the other side, such as Jones Construction, and sort of duke it out, so to speak, and then have a finding in my favor on that. This is all related to a default judgment. Okay, And so to just finish up on the service issues, we properly served them. And they knew that this was going on. And, you know, we didn't move fast. It's not like we were trying to push it through. We tried to serve them in August of 2011. We served them by publication in September and October.
Where did you mail it to with the publication? Which had the publication. And where was it published?
It was published, that's in the record at page 80. And it was published in the Nevada Legal News. And then it would have been mailed to the 5024 Alta.
Where you tried to serve.
Correct. And I'll note, I found in the record, as I was preparing, there was one other document I was going to mention to the court. Somewhere along the way, we sent one piece of a pleading. It's at pages 82 and 83. We sent a summons, complaint, and order granting the motion to enlarge time to effectuate service of process to that 5024 Alta Drive address. That was in December of 2011. So there certainly was some awareness that there was something going on. I think the other thing that's significant here is in this other case that was out there where this confession of judgment was, there's nothing going on in there. There's no attempt to execute or do anything over there. And so as we move forward, it's not until June of 2012 that we get our default judgment. So like I said, it's not like we're pushing our way through. We were trying to get not only Mitchell Capital served, but the other six or seven large creditors served so that we could move forward. And we really just wanted someone to come to the table so we could file a motion for summary judgment and then decide what we were going to do. So we end up getting a default judgment. I will candidly tell this court, as I did Judge Denton when I went in, I said to him, I said, Your Honor, we are trying to be as upfront about this as we can. We are here to ask the court to release $436,000. And how we got that number was the information that we had regarding the amount of the claims of the other creditors. And so we held that in advance because we hadn't served them yet, and they weren't at the table. And we went to the court and said, here are all of our attempts to serve process, and we laid it out for him, and ultimately he granted default judgment in our favor because Mitchell Capital and the others had been properly served, and it was granted, and he did release the $436,000 to Ms. Reynolds. Okay, so then we fast forward, we fast forward to the end of that year when Mitchell Capital comes in, Mr. Rubicki came in on their behalf and moved to set that aside. And you know, that's pretty significant for a couple of reasons. Number one, I think, is the whole service issue, I think, is a done deal because they did not raise it. And in fact, Judge Denton found that. It wasn't raised in their first motion. They didn't raise the service issue at all. They just came in and said, you should set it aside. And I think that's significant for a couple of reasons. Under 60C, if they're not served, then it provides that the court may set it aside. Okay? If they are served, the court may also set it aside, but then you go look at 60B, which then you get into inadvertence and mistake and all those different things, and none of that stuff really applies. They were properly served. We got a valid default judgment, and it should stand. And that's really the bottom line. By not raising it in their first motion, regardless, it constitutes a waiver. And we've got all that in the briefing. I have some good quotes, but I know this court knows the law on that. That's really what's important. I think I've covered the service issue. One other thing I wanted to comment on, because it has been raised by the opposing party, is this due diligence issue. And whether going just one time, it really suffices as due diligence. And a couple of comments on that. One is that it's a registered agent. Okay, they have a duty under NRS 14.020 to have a registered agent, to change the address if the address changes. And in fact, it allows for a fine if they don't have one. They have to staff it during business hours. And if they don't staff it, they actually can have a fine of $100 to $500 per day.
The order doesn't make reference as the chronology of the attempt to serve, whether or not you're mailing to the last known address, whether that actually came back or did not come back?
To my knowledge, we did not receive any back. All right, and so now I think, so I've mentioned that on this due diligence issue. You know, it's a registered agent. They have to have one. They have to be available. Went to the right place, talked to the right person. We've done what we're supposed to do. Service by publication works at that point. And so I think on the service issue, we're pretty good. I don't know if the court has other questions about that. Otherwise, I wanted to touch just a little bit on the latches issue. Sort of, and latches, waiver, and estoppel all really fit here. And we've gone through sort of all of our attempts. And then we have this reliance issue. Ms. Reynolds was looking to have order in her life, so to speak, to understand what she needed to do under the law. And that's why we came. That's why we went to court. That's why we asked the court to do that. We got a court order telling her what she can do. And she did it. And she should be able to rely on that. That's exactly what we want citizens to do, is to show up and say, here's the issue. Let's have it decided. And that's what she did. And she relied on that. And Mitchell Capital knew what was going on. And based on that, all three of those doctrines, latches, waiver, estoppel, all apply. Now, I know the court indicated that you wanted to hear a little bit of argument about the statute itself and the exemption issue. We've addressed that fairly extensively in our brief, and there's several pages of cases that I go through and distinguish the cases that Mr. Werbicki has put out there. And the main distinctions are that the statutes are different and the circumstances are different. A lot of those statutes are specific about the status of the person who buys the policy or the status of the person who receives the policy. Our statute doesn't do that. Okay, our statute says that insurance proceeds are exempt. And the, I'm sorry, let me just get that pulled up here real quick. It makes it a category of the proceeds. And then it talks about that those are exempt from the creditors of the beneficiary and the person affecting the policy. So it doesn't say if it's really a person or not a corporation, or if it's an LLC, but you know, it doesn't make those distinctions. When you look at the statute on its face, it's clear. We don't even need to get into all the cases that were cited and all that other stuff, because it's clear on its face. It's insurance proceeds. It's exempt. And that's what we were looking to do. We just wanted a determination. That's why we showed up in the first place. I'd be happy to answer any questions that the court has about that interpretation of that statute.
There's some indication that we should liberally construe this type of a statute where you might have an ambiguity and there's a lack of sufficient legislative history to go and make an analysis. Do you have any comments in that regard, how we should view that particular argument?
My response, I guess, is twofold. Number one, I don't believe it's ambiguous. It's a little confusing as written. I've got the underlining to prove it because there are a couple of exceptions stuck in the middle there. But when you get right down to it, it says that the lawful beneficiary of the signee is entitled to the proceeds and avails against the creditors and representatives of the insured and of the person affecting the same. And then down a little further, that the proceeds and avails are exempt from all liability for any debt of the beneficiary existing at the time the proceeds and avails are made available for the use of the beneficiary. To me, I don't know, we have to go to the dictionary, but you can go to the dictionary, it's going to tell you what those are. And the only other, I guess, comment to that I have is, under, I think it's NRS 0.039, it talks about what a person is, and that includes a corporation, unless it specifically says otherwise. And it doesn't specifically say otherwise. To me, this is clear on its face.
Okay. Nothing further. Questions? Got about a minute 10 left. Do you want to use it?
I don't want to talk myself into a problem. So I'll just try and, if there are no more questions, I will go ahead and have a seat. I appreciate the court's time.
Thank you. All right, at about 4:29.
Thank you, Your Honor.
That should give you plenty of time.
I'm hoping so. To begin, I'm trying to go in order associated with the notes that I have. Certainly the money being spent was done after the initial motion to set aside, so the additional spending of the money shouldn't implicate latches as of the time when the judgment was, or I'm sorry, when the motion was actually heard. One thing that I keep bringing, that keeps coming to mind is, why would Mitchell just want to be defaulted? Why would they just walk away from $750,000? Why would they try and evade service? They wanted to know about the proceeds.
Why did you not accept service? I don't understand that. I mean, I was a resident agent for all my corporations, and they never got a default against them because I always accepted service. As a resident agent, not as the attorney. They didn't necessarily have to hire me. But why would this woman accept service?
I don't know. She's a third party, a third individual that...
Are you saying, you're telling me she didn't represent Mitchell Capital or any of your clients?
No, she was just at the desk. She was...
No. I'm talking about the attorney that Mr. Aldrich was dealing with on this issue.
Ms. Ballstock.
Yes, and who had indicated she would check with her client.
There's no indication that...
There was an indication that she was not authorized to accept service.
Correct. There's no indication in the letter that she provided that she actually forwarded anything on to Mitchell Capital. We've got no real evidence that they were actually told about it. They told, admittedly, Mr. Aldrich told her about it, but I don't have anything indicating that it went forward.
We have this thing because, in addition, that's why I asked counsel. They attempted to serve the resident agent. They were told they were no longer there. Mail went to that address, which supposedly was a valid address. That mail was never returned as to the purported service, even the secondary, the judgment, and his representation, and you've not said anything different. It never came back. So it didn't just go into a black hole. That's the problem we're starting to have.
Okay. One important thing associated with that is the additional order that was sent with it. The order that was sent with it was not the publication order. It was the order extending time in which to serve. If I would have received that letter, I would have thought instantaneously, oh, they haven't served me yet, but they're going to.
Wouldn't it have been a clue to make a phone call to say what the hell is going on, opposed to just ignoring it?
Assuming that it got there, perhaps, yes.
We have to assume because it wasn't returned to them saying, you know, not accepted or not deliverable at said address or something of that nature. We keep coming up to this, and that's what I asked you earlier. We did not get a transcript. You might have read it on the hearing before Judge Denton, and it's your obligation to move us to set it aside. We didn't get that. So I don't know if this is a new argument today or the same argument you offered in front of Judge Denton.
I will send that to you as well as indicate also, it should be kept in mind that we were talking about an insurance issue.
The first thing is service. If you don't make good service, you don't even get to that issue. It's done.
Correct. And it also has to do with due diligence because, again, it's not, from my perspective, it's not my obligation to ensure that proper service is effectuated upon me.
Well, they attempted to do so. The code just requires you make due diligence. They made due diligence, at least on the surface of what we're getting here today.
This court has repeatedly indicated that a single attempt at service is insufficient.
Why shouldn't we consider the conversations with counsel and the attempts in that regard to be beyond a single attempt?
Because it was not an attempt at personal service. It was simply a phone call to a former counsel. And there was no follow-up phone call to that counsel.
If you know somebody's representing a client, it's certainly not uncommon to have the attorney contact the other attorney to say, will you accept service?
Understood, but under the same circumstances, one would think that you would submit something like a 3-day notice or some other kind of letter indicating we're about to default your client on $750,000. What are you going to do?
All right. Counsel, thank you both for your arguments and your briefs. The matter will stand submitted.